From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. We buy technology, we use technology, but how do we easily understand how it works? Tim Hunkin is an engineer, cartoonist, and inventor. He's the creator of the British television series, The Secret Life of Machines. We'll discuss the challenges of bringing technology to life. Later, I'll talk with Dan Lynch. As founder and chairman of Interop, the International Conference on Networking, Dan discusses the amazing growth in computer networks. In the syndicated British cartoon series, The Rudiments of Wisdom, Tim Hunkin has examined everything from the stomachs of a cow to the fine points of toasters. I asked him how he went from being an engineer to being a cartoonist.
I started engineering at Cambridge at the university, and when I was a child, I'd always made things, sort of strange contraptions, using little electric motors and bits of cardboard and sellotape. And I got to college and to university, and I found I couldn't make anything. I didn't have the space, and so I started drawing. Because I found something rather frustrating about the engineering, it just wasn't creative, I suppose. But also the particular course I did, it wasn't at all practical, and I just wanted to do something with my hands. So I started drawing, and I found I needed sort of, rather than just drawing in the abstract, I wanted reasons for doing drawings. And first I wrote a children's book and did drawings for that. And then I started doing a cartoon strip for one of the student papers called Stock Press, called The Rudiments of Wisdom. And it was sort of a selection of odd, absurd facts about different subjects. The first one was about cows, I remember. How cows have five stomachs and generate masses of methane and all that sort of stuff. Eventually, when I left Cambridge, I didn't have a job to go to, and I wasn't sure what to do for a while. I messed about, but doing odd bits and pieces for a year. And then one of the Sunday papers rang me up. They'd seen some of the cartoons I'd done for the student paper, and they'd been looking for a cartoon strip. So they asked to reprint the ones I'd done for the student paper. And then I carried on because it was quite successful. And I went on doing it for 14 years.
That's amazing. Now, what kinds of things did you write about in The Rudiments of Wisdom?
Well, it was sort of everything and anything, really. I started off doing my research by going to the university library that had every book that's ever been in print, and looking under the subject index, under books that began with strange and odd and peculiar. And there were these sort of compendiums of odd facts about all sorts of things. And I started sort of cataloguing them and sort of forming them into sort of areas that I could sort of write about. But then I started to rather mistrust them. They're pretty unreliable, I think, some of those books, a bit on, you know, Ripley's Believe It or Not, on that sort of vein. You don't really know whether to believe the stories. There's no way of checking up on them, really. So I sort of moved over to perhaps sort of rather more reliable sources, just sort of picking up from anything and everywhere, really. So spend a lot of time in bookshops and libraries, ringing people up, all sorts of things. The sort of more varied I could make the research, the better. It was the research, really, that I enjoyed doing the most.
Now, you've moved from cartoons into films and television. Tell us about that.
Well, basically, it was desperation. I got the sack.
It's amazing. It's amazing how motivated you can get in your career right after something like that happens to you.
Yeah. Well, 14 years is long enough to do the strip anyway. I'd had enough of it. I didn't feel that I'd had enough, but it was obvious. The writing was on the wall. They were going to... they kept changing their editor. They wanted a new look to the magazine. And I think now, in retrospect, I think it's certainly long enough to go on doing the same thing. But somewhere along the line, I'd picked up an agent, and it was his suggestion that I should try writing something for telly. I had done bits and pieces on television before. They have a regular half-hour science series that I'd written, a programme about reliability called Why Things Go Wrong. And so I had something that I could sort of take around and show people. And through doing the cartoon strip, I found that I really like doing things about ordinary, everyday things that people take for granted. And I got quite inspired doing ones about things like washing machines and vacuum cleaners and the sort of machinery around the home, because I like tinkering with that sort of thing and mending machines around my house when they go wrong. And I often thought when I was doing those cartoons that it would be much clearer if that sort of thing was on television, because you could actually see the parts working and you could sort of see the thing being taken to bits, and so much of it was visual that you could do without a lot of the words. And somehow even the drawings I was doing were frustrating, because I knew it could be better. So it was a sort of that was what gave me the idea, I think. It was a bit of a lucky fluke, really, that it ever got accepted. I think what happened, I've been told this by various people, was that my proposal landed on the controller of Channel 4 controller's desk shortly after his wife had died, and he was struggling to use his washing machine for the first time, and he said, this is what people need to know.
Certainly what he needed that
day.
Yeah. it is funny, when I was looking at some of your work, and as you're speaking today, I grew up a female, and still a female, nothing's changed. But as a female, I had no idea I was going to become an engineer. Mm. So for many, many years, I didn't look at things the way engineers look at them. And most of my compatriots who were male and engineers grew up taking toasters apart and washing machines and that type of thing. And when they saw a washing machine, they saw the insides of it. And all I saw was what you threw in. Mm. When I drove a car, I was looking at the outside and the color and the interior, but I sure wasn't looking under the hood. In fact, my father will tell you that I didn't look under the hood a few times that I should have. There was an amazing transition for me when I finally did go into engineering, and in looking on the inside and thinking about it and being able to fix it and or at least understand when it is to be fixed. And there is those two different milieus in our world today where you can simply look on the outside of a compact disc or a Walkman or whatever it is, and you can live that way, and yet you can also then go down to another level.
Yeah, well, I think it's a new sophistication, if you like, of engineering, that the majority of people can use all these machines without knowing what goes on underneath. I think if you go back 50 years or so, people generally knew far more about the machines around them, because they had to. You had to oil your sewing machine. Your car was sort of didn't always start, so you always had to lift up the bonnet on an old Ford T or something like that and fiddle around with the spark plugs or the ignition thing. But it's a sort of miracle of engineering now that you don't need to.
You need to get that involved.
Yeah, sure.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Tim Hunkin. He is a Bernard Osher Fellow at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, and he's the creator of the television series The Secret Life of Machines. Now let's talk about The Secret Life of Machines. What's that all about?
Well, this is what I've been doing now for the last 5 years. I've finished my third series now. I'm not sure I don't think I'm going to make another one. I think it's time for a change, but I'm not quite sure what to do next. I'm having a break here in America, really. It's an attempt to try and demystify these machines, because I think, although, as we were just saying, people can use all these things without knowing what goes on under the hood, to some extent there's something sort of rather frustrating about that you're sort of out of control of all these things that are around you. And I think there is a sort of latent curiosity, particularly about machines that can be quite infuriating, like washing machines or photocopiers.
Well, those are the machines that so many of us work with. We've got fax machines and word processors and that type of thing. Will you be talking about that in the series?
This latest series that's just going out on Discovery next month is all centered around the office and office machines. So it's fax machines, photocopiers, word processors, elevators, and electric lighting. Turned out to be a surprisingly interesting and intricate subject, and finally there's one which is a bit of a departure for me. It's more a sort of social history of the office. And while I was doing the initial research, I became quite fascinated by the whole idea that 150 years ago there weren't any office blocks. You had, particularly in Europe, you had really a quite sophisticated industrial base. large factories, mass producing things, but no offices. So you had a sort of complex society that managed to exist with a few thousand Dickensian clerks scribbling away. Whereas now you have a society where more than half the people work in offices. I think it's, in England anyway, it's over 50%. More than twice as many people work in offices as in factories. So it's sort of rather intangible when you actually try and analyse what all these people in offices are doing. You know, in a factory, you have sort of products that come out at the end and it takes this many people to produce that many products at the end of the day, whereas it's not easy to sort of define what goes on in an office. And it bedevils people who try and do and analyse sort of productivity of an office. And indeed, there's actually no evidence that all the technology that's been put into the office in the last 20 years has actually increased productivity.
Really? Well, I felt that way just this morning.
Well, this, I'm not sure. I mean, this may not mean that it may have improved productivity, but it's so difficult to measure that certainly it's not a clear-cut issue.
And certainly what you do and quantifying what you do has really changed. Mm. There are things that we do that we couldn't do before. So,
well, that's right.
Did that fill up the rest of the hours?
Well, yes, for instance, with a word processor, because you can go over a letter time and time again and sort of perfect it, probably means you spend just as long writing it.
That's right.
I mean, I love my word processor, but I don't know whether it actually increases my productivity.
I remember very much going over a beautiful copy of letters when we were back on just electric typewriters and realizing that I was at NASA at the time, and it wasn't that long ago. Really wanted to change one word, and you agonized. Do I send this back or not? The look on their faces when you send it back to change one word was not good. Mm. Now, how do you explain a fax machine?
How do I explain a fax machine? Well, I started out doing these teleprograms not really, not at all sure how it was going to turn out or what would work. But I suppose over the last 7 years, you sort of have got a lot better at it. I found what I like, and it's really my taste, I think, is a sort of series of, it seems to work out as a series of sort of little short magazine sort of bits in the programme. Using a variety of different styles, so I do quite a lot of animation, which is sort of using my own drawing from the cartoons, just with sort of cardboard cutouts, very primitive. Then we use quite a lot of archive film. I'm quite addicted now to watching old bits of archive film from people like General Electric of their old washing machines and that sort of stuff. Some of it's very funny, camp, kitsch. The other element that's sort of grown really is finding sort of simple demonstrations that we can do with parts of the machine, either taking them to bits or making things from scratch out of sort of simple bits and pieces. So, for instance, with the fax machine, we actually start the program with what we call a human fax, because the principle of a fax is extremely simple, really. If you look at a fax under a magnifying glass, you can see it's composed of like a lot of very sort of fine lines. You can see black and white sort of breaks down into these sort of fine lines, and it's sent over the telephone wire a line at a time. So when you send a document, it's actually broken down into a series of black segments and white segments, so it going black, white, white, black, and very much in the same way as Morse code can be sent. So anyway, what we did, we put an enormous bit of paper down on the ground, I wrote a word on it. I wrote just fax on it, and then I had a friend a quarter of a mile away, who I could signal to with these large flags. And I walked across my bit of paper in a series of lines, using a metronome to keep a regular pace to my step. And my friend had a similar metronome going at the same speed, and he had a paint roller. And whenever he saw my black flag go up, he put his paint roller down on his bit of paper. And so slowly, by going over this simple message a line at a time, he reproduced what I'd written on the ground.
So that's fascinating.
That was how we started the fax program.
But that's that truly is the scanning in of each letter and
that's right,
and
yeah.
Breaking it down for how many of those little black chunks there were and white chunks.
Yeah.
And that's what gets sent.
It's doing things with people rather than the machines. It's been quite effective, actually, in various things.
What's also interesting about that to me is that the distance is also in that experiment.
Yes, he couldn't see what I was writing, what I'd written.
Yeah, that's one of the difficulties of teaching technology and often talking about technology, as we do on the radio, waving our hands.
Yes.
And that is that you're trying to explain a particular item or element, and you lose people because some of the really essential portions of it, such as facts over distance, you're not explaining. So they're saying, well, I don't quite get it. And it's like, once you separate, we can get this because we're not in the same place, and this is how we communicate. Quite often that's important.
I think you have a much harder job on radio than I do on television, actually. A lot of it, I think, is visual. I think often the history works very well on radio, sort of stories, but of the inventors. But certainly, I depend very strongly. I work out what the pictures are going to be first, and then write some words to the minimum number of words to explain the pictures.
Well, I often say that it would be nice if, I usually in a program would like about 15 seconds of video. The rest, you know, we don't have to worry about. But that 15 seconds would be good. So people do need these cues, these visual cues and spatial cues to understand so much. My guest today is Tim Hunkin, filmmaker, engineer, and cartoonist. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. You were talking about developing some machines, and I know you have a fairly famous coin-operated machine that was, in fact, art.
Yes, well, this was an early one. When I was doing the cartoon strip, I had a fair amount of free time. I was just working for myself, and a friend of mine was having an exhibition in North London and wanted something to draw people into the gallery. And so I made him this contraption called The Birth of Venus, which was a large tin bath full of water with a lot of black dye in it, so you couldn't see what was inside. And you had to put a 2p in the slot, in the coin slot, and it pumped some of this water up to a tap about 8 foot in the air, which filled up a bucket. And when the bucket was filled, it tipped the bucket up into an enormous colander, and all the water rushing into the colander made it a lot heavier and dragged this poster of Raquel Welch out of the bath. And then as the colander drained away, she slowly sank beneath the waves. But what was a revelation for me was the amount of money that this thing took. I came back 10 days later, and it had almost forced the back of the coin box off because it was so bulging with money. And the satisfaction of sort of going away with these carrier bags weighted down with coins. I mean, it wasn't really an awful lot of money, but it was sort of something wonderfully satisfying. It's much more satisfying than getting a check at the end of the week.
That's right. It is interesting what part the art was in this.
I've produced things to go in exhibitions in the past, but I've long since stopped caring about that anymore. I don't really like the world of fine art. I find it sort of too precious and too minority interest. I like sort of popular art, really, so I think my tastes are quite vulgar in art.
And proud of it.
Yeah.
When you're doing an exhibit or a machine that's to demonstrate something, what do you have to think about?
Well, like all the things at the Exploratorium and all my coin-operated machines, well, anything in a museum, really, it's got to be sort of immensely strong. People do all sorts of awful things to machines. If there's any possibility that somebody could get their fingers stuck somewhere or break something, that they will, you know. See, over the years, it's depressing, really. You have to make... There's one of the nice things about the videos is that I can make things out of sellotape and sort of really badly because they only have to work once and much more simply. Sometimes making things that are going to be permanently installed somewhere, they become very complicated just to make them sort of safe and robust enough. You have to have sort of thick plastic everywhere covering up vulnerable parts and things. So I think that's the first thing I have to think about. And then it's interesting, people never, with the best intentions, people never sort of behave with anything I've made quite how I expect them to. So you need to have a sort of like a running in period where you correct any sort of misconceptions.
So is it that they don't use the machine the way you expected them to, or they don't learn what you expected them to?
Both, I suppose. Just before coming here, I've just finished another coin-operated machine for a place in London. Now I do actually make a serious amount of money from my coin-operated machines, because I have an arrangement where I take 50% of the money that people put in them with various places in Covent Garden, which is actually now enough to live off. And the one I was making just before I came away was a joke automatic frisking machine, because people are very paranoid about security in London, and I thought, particularly for tourists, they've just come off the plane, there's all sort of security at London Airport, that they might, just for their own security, peace of mind, like to sort of get themselves frisked. So these sort of rubber gloves come out and sort of, you know, pat them all down the sides to make sure they're not carrying a gun. Anyway, people were, in the end, with this machine, they were hanging off it and leaning on it and standing on it. I'd rashly left a sort of shelf halfway up, so I had to go back and make that into a sort of, put an additional piece in to make it into a sort of ramp that they and remove a thing at the top that they could, which the part they were hanging off, these sort of handle things. I came away, I hope I've ironed out all the teething problems on that one.
I don't know why I have a vision of a museum someday of all your coin-operated machines. Let's go back for a minute to the Secret Life of Machines series. Mm. What's coming on the Discovery Channel? Is that the latest in the series?
Yeah, that's right. This is the office ones, the facts, the... always forgetting the list. The facts, the photocopier, the elevator, the word processor, lighting, and the social history of the office.
What were the first two series about?
We started off with washing machines and vacuum cleaners, the sort of simplest domestic machines. And then in the second series, we went on to cars and engines, and also got a bit more high tech. We did things like video recorders and televisions.
How do you start with a concept that, well, sure, anybody wants to describe a washing machine or an elevator. Mm. How do you get from there to the final product?
A bit like with the cartoon strips. I like sort of approaching the research from lots of different angles. I read everything I can find about it. There's not that much in print written about things like elevators, really. So it's not too difficult. I go and see people. Once I've done some reading, you know, it's much better to do some research first, so you've got sort of things to talk to people about. But one of the things I really like about the making the films, rather than doing the cartoon strip, is having more time, and also because it's visual, I also do quite a lot of research with my hands, if you like, by sort of taking, not with an elevator particularly, but with the smaller machines, I take them to bits and try and puddle out how they work and think how I could use bits of whatever I find inside and to make demonstrations. And also then reading the history of the whatever it happens to be, we sometimes try and recreate some of the early experiments or the early prototypes. We made a model of a full-size model of Otis's first safety lift. It was quite good fun. That was sort of 25 foot high, and we performed Otis's experiment that he did at the New York Fair in 1853, where he was hoisted up on this lift 20 foot above the ground, and his assistant then cut through the supporting rope, and this sort of safety ratchet thing meant it dropped a foot or so and then locked into place.
I think most people, when they get on elevators in these big buildings, just assume that they're going to work. They don't have a sense that if something happened, they would be stopped.
Yeah, but they may have a sense they're not going to die. But I think that the fear of getting stuck in a lift is still quite real, because over the years, as they've added more and more and more safety features to lifts. The whole philosophy of designing elevators, I call them lifts, because I keep remembering they're elevators over here, is that if anything goes wrong with any of the sensors or any of aspect of the lift, that the lift stops. And so in some ways, the likelihood of the lift stopping between floors is now greater than it was 20 years ago, I think.
So that perhaps we haven't progressed here.
Well, I think you're less likely to die, but you're more likely to get stuck.
I guess that's good.
So I think there's a lot of psychological fear, anyway, of lift, probably quite justified. Also, you know, you're in this funny little confined box, sort of very unnaturally close to sort of complete strangers, sealed up with them. It's quite an unnerving experience, really.
Do you narrate these series?
Yeah, yeah. It's very much a sort of homemade sort of approach. They take ages to make because I do so much of it myself. I do my own research and then I collaborate with somebody else to make the models and somebody else to do the animation and somebody else to do the editing. So there's me and Liz, who's the producer, and we work on it right from start to finish with other people coming in at various different stages. But it in some ways it's painfully slow. It takes me nearly 2 years to make 6 half-hour programs. But in other ways, it's very good because most television tends to be made much, much quicker than that. And I think, you know, the fun of it for me really is the research and being able to sort of delve into these things. And the satisfaction is sort of at least feeling that we've sort of tried as much as we can to to do it well. So I would hate actually to do it quicker.
What's next?
I don't know. It's nice being here, just as a sort of as a break, really. I'm deliberately not thinking about it. I'm just getting absorbed with being at the Exploratorium and messing around with their exhibits at the moment. I have actually got a job when I get back for the winter for the Science Museum in London, refurbishing one of their galleries. So I'm not going to be unemployed. I'm going to be busy actually till next summer. But I don't know. I mean, they want me to. They're very popular in England. They get these programs go out in prime time, 8:30 in the evenings, and they get large audiences. But I sort of feel there's a sort of danger in just going on, that they could become sort of like formula, and I think maybe I need a change. I'm not sure what, but I thought, I decided the thing was to escape from it all for a while.
Well, I can't imagine that you're really going to be, if you're churning these out at a total of 3 hours every 2 years, I don't think they'll get too flat too soon.
No, you're probably right. I'm sort of restless enough anyway with that. But I think we might do something about materials. That's one thing I'm interested in, sort of to do rather it, like we've done Everyday Machines, to do something about everyday materials. I think the history of the use of metals and plastics and wood and things is very interesting.
Do you think people will want to know more about their environment and how everything is working?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. This is what slightly, I think maybe people are slightly more involved with the machines around them than the materials around them. I sort of, you know, with the machines, you can't always ignore them. When your washing machine stops working, you have to get involved in thinking about how it works to some extent.
My guest today has been Tim Hunkin. He is the creator of the television series The Secret Life of Machines, airing this fall on the Discovery Channel. You're listening to TechNation, Americans and Technology. Dan Lynch is founder and chairman of InterUp, an international networking conference which recently brought 65,000 people to San Francisco. I asked Dan what could possibly draw so many people to a technical conference.
Hope. They hope to learn something. about how to get all of their crazy computers to work together. I mean, that's what brings them. I started this thing, you know, many years ago because I thought that people really would like to have all these different computers talk together. And I started out with a very technical conference for just a few hundred people, and all basically manufacturers, engineers, and to try to help them make their machines work together. And 6 or 7 years later, we have, you know, 65,000 people trying to do it. Only they're not all trying to do it, hopefully, at that deep technical level. They're trying to do it at a, you know, more application level and a real world, you know, in their businesses level.
So some of these people really are the old techie engineers trying to get it at the bit level working.
Oh, yeah.
Others are more of the business sort that say, I have 5 computers or 20 computers or 100 computers, and they need to all network together.
Yeah, we have ponytails and 3-piece suits, you know, side by side, because, you know, the 3-piece suit people or the 2-piece suit people are, you know, they're the business people. They're trying to use this technology in their business to get business advantage. And this is where they can come to get the information they need to make the buying decisions that they know they need to make. But still, the industry, the networking industry, is still, you know, expanding and trying new things and trying to, like cable TV, bringing that into the computer networking game. And that's technical goo, right? And that takes ponytails or, you know, takes
I like
real
this
engineer
distinction, the ponytails and the 3-piece
suits. That's right, you know.
Now, what do they learn? Do they just come and look at vendors or is there much more to learn?
Well, there are two aspects, really, to the Interop Week. And there's the people who go to the conference and the tutorials, and that number is actually 1/10 of the other number. That's 6,500 people who come for, you know, Monday and Tuesday, 2 days of intensive training at the feet of a master, really, you know, someone who invented a protocol or a technology. And we get those people to come out of their ivory towers, research institutes, wherever they are, and teach to 200 to 300 to 400 people per class, you know, how it works, you know, and really the details of some underlying technology, like wonderful TCP/IP or X400 mail, or, you know, Sun's NFS network file system technology, ATM fundamentals, whatever the hot, you know, actual underlying technologies are. We teach people who really want to know, you know, bits and bytes, right? And then that's followed by 3 days of conference, and with, like I said, about 6,000 or 7,000 people who are primarily users bragging about, you know, how they failed. You know, they have the pioneers love to brag about the arrows in their backs, right? And they do that to share their experience with their fellow human beings so they don't get so many arrows. You know, they're going to get some, right? But when you're always using new technology, you always make some mistakes. But so the conference is mainly made up of people sharing their experiences. First 2 days, learning from a master. Okay, and then 3 days of sharing your experiences so other people can learn from your, you know, mistakes and from your, you know, from your good experiences, too. I mean, you want to copy a master. You always want to do that, right?
Right.
And improve, you know. Try to stand on more than someone's tiptoes, you know. Maybe get up to the kneecaps. And then the last 3 days, we have the exhibition, which, you know, in parallel with the conference, you know. So if you get bored at a session, you can, you know, hit the floor, right? And there we also get, as is obvious, another 50 or 60,000 people who, you know, are just interested in products. And they come to see all the different exhibitors, you know, showing how all their hardware and software and services work on this giant network. We build a network for the trade show. It takes all year long to plan this network. We have hundreds of volunteers who do, I mean, I have a paid staff, you know, 6 people on my staff who organize it, and they're engineers, but they can't do it all themselves. They don't know how to operate all the 500 different kinds of equipment that are there. That's too much, you know, so we rely on many other people to help us, you know, build this thing. It's like 80 miles of cable, you know, fiber and copper and coax and
I don't know. So you install a network right on the exhibition floor.
Right in the exhibition floor at Moscone Center over here, okay? I mean, it's, you know, we stage it. We have a warehouse in Sunnyvale. We stage it all out and lay out all the wires and cut things to length and all that jazz, you know. And then we run in there, you know, and in 2 days or less than 2 days, you know, throw this stuff up everywhere. It's madness, you know, and get the phone companies to come in and put in all their outside connections in a heck of a hurry. They're very high-speed links. They put the fastest stuff on the planet in over here because that's what you want to see, right? You know, and then, you know, the network is up and running, and so you go to a booth and you say, hey, show me your stuff works with this other guy's stuff, and, you know, everything's in place, and if you can't show, there goes the sale, right? I mean, you know, and that's the plan. We have this, you know, quote. We say, you know, I know it works. I saw it at Interop. I mean, the proof is in the pudding, right? You know?
That is very different.
Yeah.
Because normally you're reading brochures, you're talking to a guy, you see an ad, you look for a review. But the point is you say, I've got this, and it's configured this way.
Yeah.
And
I've got some Novell NetWare, and I got some TCP/IP, and I got some SNA, you know, and all this jazz, and, you know, all this technical talk, you know, these different methods for computers to send information around. And of course, see, the beautiful world, in a beautiful, pure world, you know, if we could, you know, start over, you know, we'd only have one method for sending data around, right? But that'll never happen. and so we had to figure out ways of making it all work together. It's kind of like, you know, there's a search for Esperanto, right, but in the human language area, but it doesn't really happen. And you have to have translators and, you know, and They're bulk languages like English and French and Russian and Chinese and Japanese, and then lots of fragmented languages, you know, that
dialects,
have dialects and things like that, different dialects of English, right, or American or Tennessean or whatever. And so we just focus on, you know, kind of helping things get close together without ever having tried to be perfectly together because it's a hopeless cause.
When you started out, your first conference in 86 had just a few hundred attendees, and now you've got 65,000. Did you find this dramatic success so surprising?
Yeah. The surprise that actually happened in the last 2 years. I was not surprised up until the last couple of years. It went very well. You know, it went from 300 to sort of 30,000. Okay. And I, you know, said, that's about right. There are about that many people who ought to be serious about this stuff, right? And because I could just sort of count, you know, in the large corporations and in the manufacturers about how many people it would need to know. Okay, and then what has happened, the reason it's getting even bigger is frankly because it's becoming mainstream. And the network, it's the very nature of networking, and I never really thought this out, it just happened,
uh-huh.
You know, and the very nature of networking is that the more people who get on the network, the more other people want to get on to get a hold of them, and then someone wants to get on to get a hold of them, you know, and it's a snowball effect. I mean, it is a marketplace, it's a meeting place, and so once it gets successful, once there's enough good stuff on there, then it just, there's a dog pile, and it's the dog pile effect, okay, that I didn't foresee, and that's what's happening now. And it's just, you know, it's amazing. I mean, people say, well, Dan, at 65,000, what's going to be? 100,000, 500,000? Well, not 500,000, certainly. We have to start to segment it. But, you know, the point is that the network, the idea of a network or an internet or the network of all networks, the World Wide Web, that's what people want. There's immense value to humanity to have everybody connected. You know, have all the data be able to be moved anywhere and all your communications to be able to move from any point to any point. And that's what we're seeing. So we're seeing that the popularity of that and you know, I don't know, it's just growing.
Well, you know, it is amazing to me because I've been involved in the technical world for so many years,
right.
And we've seen some of the network happening, and we read statistics about people, how many users are online, and we read how much data is being transferred and how much money is being spent. But until I saw 65,000 people actually spending their time to come someplace for a week to talk about it and learn about it, that really got my attention. That's not even a little city.
Yeah, no, that's
pretty big place.
It's big, and it, you know, it's valuable to people. I mean, the point is that people want to get on a network. They get hooked up to it. When they see it, they're sucked in, right? It's like a drug, and so they want to get on. And I know all I ever have to do is introduce them. If I can get them in the door once, you know, show it to them, they're hooked, because you just have an act. The reason you're hooked is you have this universe that opens up before you, a whole new world of just huge amounts of information, people you can make contact with immediately, and you never want to leave.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dan Lynch. He is chairman and founder of Interup, which offers conferences and exhibitions internationally on computers and communications. Next year, Interup will put on 3 conferences internationally for the first time in Berlin, Tokyo, and Paris. Why those cities? And what do you think the response will be?
Well, let's see. Paris and Berlin are rather big European locations. The French and the German markets are the two largest markets in Europe. And Tokyo is not a small market. I mean, there are 25 million people in Tokyo. And a few years ago, I decided that I wanted to take this thing internationally, because after all, networking is an internationally capable thing, right? You know, the water doesn't stop you from wanting to communicate. And satellites do just fine, and underground cables do just fine. And we were having thousands of people from overseas coming to Interop in the U.S. And, you know, business light bulb in my head went off. Gee, you know, I'll bet they have a lot of friends who can't afford to come, you know, who want to be able to see this kind of thing. And so we started out in Europe. And with our mindset, start out in Europe, because I, frankly, am closer to that culture and knowing what's going on, you know. And then I started a parallel action in Japan. It took me a few more years to start to develop real good business partnerships and relationships in Japan. And I did not want to, when I say that, what I mean is I did not want to just bring my show there. I wanted to bring the concept there, hire native teams, and teach them how to do it. And because there are cultural differences. There's different technologies that are more prevalent in various locations around the planet, and different ways people use networks and want to use networks. And I just know that people love networking, period. And, you know, how it instantiates itself in any location is a cultural issue.
We talked about Internet in the show before, and I think most people grasp that 15 million users in 38 countries are somehow interconnected over a global computer network. And some of us in the computer profession used ARPANET 20 years ago,
right,
and have been, you know, trundling along ever since. Tell us how ARPANET and Internet developed and your various roles in it.
Sure. Well, the ARPANET was conceived of in 1962 by a man named Paul Barron, who was a researcher at the RAND Corporation. And he was charged with the idea of designing a data communication system that would survive nuclear war. That was the charter. So he was funded by, you know, the Department of Defense to design some way of sending messages, and these were really just text messages, you know, between, you know, orders and commands, and move 60 tanks here and get an airplane over there, that kind of stuff, to make it so that it would be a survivable technology. So that was the original plan, okay? And so he thought about how to do it, his solution was to have, you know, lots of little message switches all over the place, and so you could bomb any one of them, there'd still be an alternate path, you know, kind of like detours on freeways and things like that, you know. And so he designed that. The first one was built in 1969, and they called it the ARPANET after the funding agency, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. And that grew up to about 100 computers by 1975. And at many at all at research institutions around the United States, and a few in Europe that were on pretty much from near the beginning. And in early 73, say about 4 years after this thing got into existence, the people who were running it, you know, sort of the light bulb went off in their heads, you know, there's going to be more than one of these. You know? And this thing used telephone wires, okay, but there's going to be radio. There's going to be, you know, lasers. There's going to be things that we don't even know about that are going to make it so you can't have everything on the same set of wires, right, the same underlying technology. So we have to design a network of networks, That was the concept of the internet. We're going to have many different kinds of networks, and then on top of that, we're going to have to be able to bridge across those networks, much like you take airplanes to get to foreign countries or things like that. And so the concept of the internet was born, and the first other network was this packet radio network, which you now see as mobile communications, and you can buy them for $1,000. Well, they were $500,000 a box when we were doing research on that in the 70s. And then the thing just started growing. After that, the ARPANET kept growing. The military decided they wanted to use it, but they didn't want to use the same network that the researchers were on, and the hackers, right? But they want to have their own same technology, but separated. And so there were other military networks that were, built out of the same equipment, and they were connected together at certain safe points, safeguard points where you could put security measures, between the two worlds. And that the internet just sort of started that way. And by the early 80s, more and more people were finding out about it, and they were kind of climbing on and cheating, if you know what I mean. They didn't have government contracts, but they saw how beautiful this was, or they had worked on a government contract or worked in a university and then left that environment and went to work for Chevron or, Mobil or General Motors and said, hey, I got to still be able to communicate with my colleagues on the research world, and I'll figure out a way to do it. And so it started happening, And then there was a realization, well, we can't, this is sleazy, And so people started building, commercial portions of the internet, because after all, the internet is just a collection of networks. And so, some guys who were running university networks, quit their jobs and, went out and started a commercial version of it. And now the commercial side is 10 times larger than the, government side. It's just obviously an idea that was right.
So conceptually, we're talking about a number of networks. By agreeing how they're going to communicate and giving certain access, they're able to access each other.
That's right. Yeah, that's the magic, is agreements.
There's no big company, which is internet, and they control the lines.
Oh, that's right. That's the beautiful part. You see, this thing, you love it. There's no one's in charge. No one's in charge. There's no one to ask permission of, right?
The new world.
The new world. Oh, it's the most democratic universe you've ever seen. And this was designed by a military command, right? You usually think of them as very hierarchical and all that jazz, top down. But they knew that if they wanted to design a communication system that no one could damage, it had to be non-hierarchical. There's no one bomb would put you out of commission, right? So they set up a completely democratic network. It's kind of amusing. Yeah.
My guest today is Dan Lynch, founder and chairman of InterUp. He has over 20 years' experience implementing large-scale computer networks. What was your role in development as we went along?
Okay, well, I was a computer center manager at SRI when I first ran into this in 1973. And I was in a thing called the Artificial Intelligence Center, this old AI stuff or new AI stuff, whatever you call it, smart computers, computers that work like and think like humans. Only I was not one of those geniuses. I was just the computer center manager. I was the guy that ran their machines and made it do their daily work, text processing and machine language stuff. And we had lasers and robots and a lot of weird stuff hanging off of it. And so I helped them change the hardware, change the software, to test out their ideas. And we were a node on the ARPANET. We were just one machine. There were many machines at SRI that were on the ARPANET, and we were one of them. And there were some guys back at BBN who, Bolt, Baranka, and Newman, one of the research institutes that was the guys that wrote the first ARPANET code and the first box, the first switching box called an IMP, Interface Message Processor. And they were working on this design of this new thing, this internet protocol, which is called TCP/IP now. And one day, one of the guys that was doing that, called me up or sent me some email and said, "Hey, Dan, how'd you like to help debug this? Get it, test
to
help us
we
test
gotta
the
send
code.
It to somebody we to make
send
sure
it, some,
it works.
Yeah, right, get it out of the room and all that jazz." And so I said, "Sure, so I just helped these guys debug this code for a couple of years. we didn't know what we were doing. That's called research, right?
Right.
and so basically by 1978, we were done. We finished, it's working. Next project, that's neat, go to the next thing. And And so that was sort of my introduction to it. I was really, you know, one of the developers. I wasn't one of the creators, but I was one of the practical guys, you know. And then in the early 80s, I moved to ISI, to Information Sciences Institute, down in Los Angeles, which was the largest node on the ARPANET, and running these big time-sharing machines. And my job there was to kill it, was to kill time-sharing, go out and get these new workstations and PCs and Ethernets and things like that that we see now. And I got the very first versions of them, bought serial numbers 1, 2, and 3 of a lot of boxes, some of which survived, like Sun, and some of which didn't, like PERC. Okay, that came from Carnegie Mellon University. And get them working and then put them in the field, in the hands of my customers who had been coming in over long-distance networks, and put their local area nets in place for them, and then connect them to the Internet so they could still communicate amongst everybody, but essentially have a local network and then be connected to the Internet. So that was my role for ARPA, was to start the Internet going in, you know, on-site locations at Army bases and at different universities and things like that. And then in 83, I said, gee, this is really happening. I want out of here. I want to get into this real world, you know, that's really going on. I want to get out of the research world. And so I didn't know how to do that, and I quit my job and moved back up here to Silicon Valley and hunted around for startups and things like that. And I was pretty naive and just mostly engineering. But I wanted to get into marketing, really. I didn't want to get into engineering. I wanted to get in helping people learn how to use this stuff and be convinced that it was good, because I had basically been a service manager, you know, and mm-hmm. knew if people, how they loved it. Once they tasted it, they loved it, and the rest of humanity would love it too. And no one would hire me, you know, because I was an engineer and I wasn't a marketing guy, you know. And that's what led me finally to put this conference on, this little technical conference for all these engineers, so that I could prove to their companies that I knew where, you know, what worked and what didn't work and where things were going. So that got me not what I expected. It didn't get me a job. It you know, with a particular group, they all just said at the end of that meeting, you know, gee, this is wonderful. You should do more of this, you know, for the rest of our company and our customers. And I just went, wow, you know, marketing 101, find a need and fill it. Here are customers. They're telling you what they want to buy.
And you can give it
and
to
I
them.
And I can give it to them. Okay, right, you know. So I just decided to go into the conference business. I mean, conferences aren't that hard to put together conceptually, right? You know? Well, little ones aren't. Big ones with 65,000 people are major work. And of course, over the years, I've, you know, hired a lot of really bright people to help me do all that. And fortunately, today I don't do any of it. You know, any of the real work. I mean,
well, you were looking for a job, and you ended up with your own international company.
Right.
Yeah, things. Mr. Lucky, we like to call you.
It's dumb luck is what you call it, right? Yeah, I say, you know, my brilliance was I didn't mess it up once I found it.
There you go. There you go. Now, what new technologies coming down the pipe do you see as having major impact on the global networking? And local networking, for that matter.
Well, speed. I mean, I used to think it was sort of silly. You know, why do you want faster things? Okay, well, the answer is I have a 3-year-old daughter, okay, and she got real sick of my computer recently being too slow, and she hits a double click. I mean, she wants it immediately. None of this 2-second wait for, you know, the screen to light up. And so I got her, you know, the hottest machine on the planet, okay. And
this is your 3-year-old daughter?
My 3-year-old, that's right, okay. She's the real consumer, you know, of tomorrow. I mean, you know, you're going to show someone some technology, you feed it to a 3-year-old, okay, if it satisfies them, you know, that's, you know, make it cheap and everyone will buy one, right? And what we're getting now is, you know, we've had fast computers for the last 2 or 3 years that are, you know, a couple $1,000. I mean, and they'll be a couple $100 in a few more years, right? And that means, you know, it's the $200 price, right? Is once you get to $200, bingo, everyone will buy one. And that's all very right in range. What we need is high-speed communication so that you can move the data around and get, you know, video on demand or huge data files or the whole encyclopedia, you know, from wherever it is on the planet into in front of you in 2 seconds, right? Because that's, well, as long as people want to wait. And that requires very, very high-speed networks. And that's what fiber's all about. And, you know, silicon fiber, right? And it's coming, you know, fast and furious and cheap as sin. And it's going to be unbelievably cheap by the turn of the century to have billions of bits per second, which is, as I call it, FMV, you know, full motion video color, okay, you know. It's just going to be wonderful.
Full motion video color, yeah. over
cable TV, over a network. It doesn't matter, you know, over the phone system, through the air. It's all coming in. I mean, there's tons of mobile, you know, air, you know, communications coming into existence with smaller and smaller cells, so that you can switch more and more data. Believe me, the technologists are out there, you know, seeing the, you know, the insatiable appetite of human beings, and you know, and trying to satisfy us. So, the hard part's going to be, okay, here's this library of goo. How do I find what I want? How do I navigate through this universe of infinite data? That's where the value add is going to come, you know, in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. Is you know, this 500 channel TV channel thing? No, it's going to be 5 million channels, and there's no way you can navigate that even with
the
high speed.
You can spend the rest of your life just flipping through the channels.
Just flipping through the channels once. Exactly right. You know. And it's going to blow away the publishing industry, the television industry. I say blow them away. It's going to have them, put them on a completely different economic basis. And because bits are cheap, you know, you can get all the data in the world, you know, in a couple of seconds. Now, but not in front of you, you know, but now how are you going to sift through it? Who are you going to pay for what? How are we going to do advertising? Advertising is going to be very fascinating in this new world, because right now we do advertising, it's broadcast advertising, right? You know, they print 50,000 copies or they buy airtime, you know, on some broadcast medium, TV, radio, and they presume there's an audience out there. They build a message, and then it goes, right? And a million readers or viewers, you know, get it, right? Or 10 million or whatever it is. And, you know, it has its effect, you know. Most half people are dozing out of the room, getting a beer.
That's when you go and leave, yeah.
Yeah, right, you know. And what you really want is, you know, that when you're in kind of a buying mood, you know, then you want information, right? And you want it immediately. Well, how would you like to have a situation where, you know, you're getting stimulated by some kind of advertising because you've kind of told the advertisers, you know, it's a trust issue here, but you tell the advertisers kind of a profile of yourself and the things you're interested in, the things you're not interested in, and they send you kind of little teasers and, you know, without hurting you too much, kind of Coca-Cola ad kind of stuff. It kind of gets you interested, right? Okay. And then you click and boom, 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 and you tell them, show that to me in gray. No, I want this 3 feet tall, not 2 feet tall. And with simulation and everything, you know, you can just get it presented to you right on your screen right in front of you, and you can press buy, and bingo, it's, you know, credit card's already in somewhere, and you got it, and it'll be delivered UPS tomorrow. I mean, eventually, you know, getting hard objects through the network is, you know, the next challenge, okay? That's the beam me up Scotty thing. I'll leave that for, you know, the real
jumps
future.
Out of your
yeah,
set.
Yeah, right. That I'm not worried, you know. I had this image of the machine one day where there's sort of, you know, backyard dirt in, you know, in the sort of hopper, right? You know, and then the wish box in the middle, and out comes, yeah, everything.
Everything. Yeah. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Mara, it was my pleasure.
My guest today has been Dan Lynch, named by Communications Week magazine as one of the top 25 visionaries in the computer industry. Dan is founder and chairman of InterUp. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.